Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Friday. It is the Friday before the election. It's hard to believe that I'm saying there's 4 days to go until Election Day. So this is our weekend podcast, and by popular demand, Tim Miller is joining me. Tim Miller, who must spend about 20 hours a day doing podcasts, right? Doing other people's podcasts.
Is Charlie, you're number one on my list, but I do have a disproportionate number of podcast and live stream appearances. Not 20 hours.
You do the Snapchat thing. You do the podcast. You do all of these other things. You do MSNBC. It's like your little cottage industry of Tim Millerism.
You know, we have to be multi-platform content creators in 2020, Charlie. It's part of the deal.
That's absolutely true. So I'm trying to figure out where do we start here, because we are right up against it, and in terms of polls all over the place, anxiety spiking. I wrote something this morning, and I just wanted to kind of bounce it off you, okay? Before we get into the whole Miles Taylor, free speech, Don Jr., all of this stuff, Rudy Giuliani, Tucker's lost UPS package, which I love, by the way.
Love.
So I was thinking about the final days of this campaign and the closing message. And the question, well, is there an October surprise coming, kind of a Comey last minute thing? And then it occurred to me that, you know, Donald Trump really needed an October surprise. And this is the kind of way he thinks, of course. He's the executive producer of everything. And he not only got an October surprise, he got a whole bunch of October surprises. I mean, you think about the month of October, and by his standards, pretty much everything broke his way. I mean, okay, leaving aside the pandemic and people dying and the fact that he didn't get a stimulus package and various other things like that, and couldn't get Bill Barr to do certain, you know, indict certain folks. But beyond that, he had an amazing run of what would have been good luck for anybody else. I mean, you think back, if this was the beginning of October and I say, hey, you know what's going to happen in the next month? Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to die, and he's going to be able to ram through a new Supreme Court justice. A week before the election, he's going to be able to stand there on the balcony, and he's going to be able to cement a 6-3 majority. He's going to have, high profile ceremonies where he's going to sign Mideast peace accords, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to be diagnosed with the coronavirus, but he's going to recover, and he's going to have this triumphant return to the White House with helicopters and like something out of a Michael Bay movie. They're going to discover Hunter Biden's laptop. There's going to be more riots in Philly, so he's going to be able to play the law and order card. And then finally, 5 days before the election, we have these amazing economic numbers. You know, GDP growing 7% in the third quarter. That's annualized. That is a 30% growth rate, which has just never, ever happened before in the history of anything. And so this would be like the best possible gift that any president would have the Thursday before the election. So all of these things happened in October, and Donald Trump is still screwed. He's still on track, I think, for an historic defeat. And so it does make you wonder. I mean, you know, I'll throw it to you. I'm going to throw it back to you. But, you know, look at this and go, here's a guy who's handed all of these great cards, and it's not working for him because this is the pandemic election, and he cannot wish that away with his magical thinking. And number two, he's Donald freaking Trump, and he is who he is. And this is a man who was never going to rise to the occasion, can't stay on message. And so what do we have? We have the airing of his grievances, the verbal rhetorical diarrhea that we've become accustomed to. And so you get a guy that could have been talking about the Supreme Court, could have been talking about the economy, could have been talking about world peace. And instead, you have him talking about everything. You talk about Hunter Biden and how we got to throw Miles Taylor in jail. It's really quite extraordinary when you think about it, how much stuff has happened and how little it's helped Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, on a couple of those things, I think you're trying to shine the turd a little bit.
On the
president contracting the coronavirus out of his own incompetence at the,
awesome.
You know, Amy and but at the Amy Coney Barrett event at the Supreme Court event. So, you know, he tainted two of those items that you laid out there. And you know, the reality is that
picky.
The reality is that it's, you know, there are two overriding things here. One of them, which you mentioned, is just the nature of Donald Trump and just his, grossness and his unpopularity and the fact people don't like him. But then, and then also this virus, though, this virus that he hasn't been able to manage, that's now again getting worse and worse. And so, you know, these two things just overshadowed all of that. And so I agree with you that it also, Donald Trump didn't play his cards as well as he could have. If he was a different human, if he wasn't as, you know, fundamentally flawed as he is, he might have been able to to play this hand a different way. But that was never going to happen.
But actually, that's the October non-surprise. The Trump is Trump. He's always going to be Trump. He's never going to be anybody different. Yeah. He's never going to be empathetic. He's never going to be competent. He's never going to rise to the occasion, right?
Yeah. You know? Being the president is a lot different than not being the president. Yeah. This seems like an obvious statement, but for Trump in particular, you know, I mean, he's really in his wheelhouse talking about how bad everybody else is. You know, I mean, that's a slow fastball down the middle of the plate for Donald Trump. And that's what he got to be in 2016. Hillary's bad and Obama's bad and Bush is bad and all these people are idiots. That's a different animal than having to say I'm good, right? And I managed these crises that are facing your lives well. And not only is he not good at the management, he's not particularly good at the case. He's good at hyperbole. He's good at saying he's the greatest, but his heart isn't really in that, right? His heart is in saying other people are terrible, and that's you know what he kind of reverts back to.
Sleepy Joe. Amazingly, that looking back on it, his gift for coming up with, you know, just the right, you know, seventh grade jibe, he lost it because Sleepy Joe didn't work, because all of America said we're okay with that. We're okay with Sleepy.
Yeah, it was like I had you know, this was like my fifth on my little notepad of Bulwark articles I want to write. This was like the fifth bullet for, you know, basically the last 5 months, and I just never got around to it. It was just the fact that Trump's inability to nickname Biden, as ridiculous as that seems, like, was actually really telling. And how flailing his campaign is, like, that he couldn't even come up with something that simple, that he couldn't figure out how to define Joe Biden, which is something that should be his top strength.
Okay, I don't have a soundbite on this, but I want to read you something he said in Tampa yesterday, because it is so classic. So he's going off on one of his word salads. He says, I get a call from the experts, right? Guys that ran for president 6, 7, 8 times, never got past the first round. Is he talking about Lindsey Graham? I don't know. But they're calling me up and saying, sir, you shouldn't be speaking about Hunter. You shouldn't be saying bad things about Biden because nobody cares. I disagree. Maybe that's why I'm here and they're not. But they say, talk about your economic success. Talk about 33.1%, the greatest in history. Now, look, if I do, I mean, how many times can I say it? I'll say it 5 or 6 times during the speech, 33.1. But you look at that and you look at Tucker Carlson, what he did the other night. Great, great. And followed up by Sean and followed up by Laura. And the next day, nothing at all, right? Okay, so that is so classic. It's almost like you had to, you know, go to a laboratory and make up the perfect quote there, because, you know, people are going, Mr. President, you really ought to be talking about the economics, you know, relate to people in the world. And he's going, yeah, I could do that, but that's boring. You know, look at what Sean was saying. And look, he lives in that bubble.
Jane Costin wrote an amazing Vox story about how the extremely online campaign that Donald Trump is running, and how he's just obsessed with all of these minor, you know, issues that are only intelligible if you like spend all day watching Fox and reading Breitbart and Gateway Pundit. And it is like he just tells on himself in that statement. It's like, these guys are calling me and telling me to help myself and give me good advice, and I'm telling them to pound sand.
Yeah.
I'm telling them to pound sand, losers. We're going to talk about the Bubalinski gambit instead. And but this is just, that was also true in 2016, right? It was the context around it was different. And I think that the campaign also had, you know, more of a, you know, more people around him who could shape him. Right. I mean, Trump was never managed. And, you know, there's this whole notion that you could have adults around him. There was never that. But, you know, Bannon and Kellyanne and some of these folks in 2016 did, I think, have the ability to get him to focus on the forgotten man and all the bullshit that he never actually cared about. But that was good. That was good branding. And he bought into that. And I just don't think that there's anybody left to do. I mean, obviously, but as evidenced by the fact that people are calling him and telling him to do the right thing, and he's making fun of them on the stage. You know, he doesn't have anybody to do that. It's Bill Stepien is not doing that.
No, he's trying to just plug the holes in the broken up Death Star.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is still one of the most fascinating stories. So speaking of the coronavirus, because I mean, this is going to be the overriding story, is that his handling of the pandemic, I think has been fatal, but also the way he has locked into this narrative that it's no big deal. And it is amazing to me, because I'm sitting right here in Wisconsin. This is the biggest story in Wisconsin. We are just being hammered here. The hospitalization rates are going up. They have a field hospital at the State Fair Park. We're like number three in the country in terms of new cases. He was here last week and he made fun of it, did the whole COVID. That's all the media wants to talk about. You know, his son had it for 16 seconds, treating it like a joke. And he's coming back to Green Bay, which if you look at the national map, that's the really red spot. It's where the thumb of Wisconsin is. And he's coming back and he's going to be doing that. And it is kind of amazing. I mean, the tone deafness and the callousness is kind of amazing, but also the super spreader events. But it's a family affair. So here's Don Jr. Is on with Laura Ingraham, and he's sharing his great insights into the coronavirus. Let's play that.
These people are truly morons. You know what I mean? And I like how they go after Scott Atlas because he's not an epidemiologist, but Sanjay Gupta now magically is. I mean, give me a break, Laura. The reality is this. If you look, I put it up on my Instagram a couple days ago because I went through the CDC data because I kept hearing about new infections. But I was like, well, why aren't they talking about this? Oh, because the number is almost nothing, because we've gotten control of this thing. We understand how it works. They have the therapeutics to be able to deal with this. If you look at that, look at my Instagram. It's gone to almost nothing.
excuse me. I apologize.
God, you have to laugh. It's so angry.
Yeah, fuck me. I mean, seriously, it's like there's another one of those classic moments. Don Jr. referring to other people as morons, talking about how he's going through the data and he's posting this data on his Instagram account that says that there's almost no one is dying on a day when about 1,000 Americans are dying every single freaking day.
Yeah, Charlie, I'm just kind of warming up over here because there's so many things I can just go off on that. The Donald Trump Instagram thing is both sad and comic, but also, sort of dire, right? There are people that are getting their information from Donald Trump Jr.'s Instagram feed. And this is going to be a long, you know, thing that we'll get to talk about on this podcast for many years to come, no matter what happens tomorrow, because it's a problem. And number one. And number two, you know, he's on Fox. And I've gone on this rant the last few days for people who have been on Bulwark stuff about how I the biggest story in the country right now is that the president continues this tour that you're talking about, where you go through Wisconsin and Don Jr. derisively attacks Sanjay Gupta for just saying the facts, which is, if you look at the numbers in almost all of the places Donald Trump has gone, you see a uptick in cases. You know, there's this whole town in North Carolina, Gastonia, where they can't even contact trace anymore. They're just like, everybody might have it, so everybody's just got to stay at home, literally, after Trump went to have an airport rally then. And I've felt like there hasn't been, you know, the media's gotten bored with this story a little bit. And, you know, with the exception of a couple, you know, cable news shows. Even more responsible than them is like the fact that there's once again just this utter failure of everyone around Donald Trump. You know, the fact that like Laura Ingraham cannot even basically, you know, give a mild pushback to this. You know, the fact that Fox News, which is supposed to be a news station whose viewers disproportionately are affected by this virus, can't just report the facts about the 250,000 deaths that are happening in this country. The fact that there's not a single Republican elected official, not a single one, who has said, you know what, I don't think that the president should be doing these tours. And I'm not going to. I'm not going to participate.
Yeah.
No, they're all participating. You know, they're all participating. They're doing their own mini COVID tours. You know, like Tom Cotton's going around Iowa right now into little diners where in closed spaces where he's breathing all over people. Obviously, much smaller crowds because Tom Cotton has no charisma. But still, over the CDC guidelines. And so, you know, you listen to this Donald Trump Jr. and it's just hard. It's hard not to just laugh and then to cover up the rage.
Well, but this is the message. And I don't know that the Trump world could have really hit upon a worse message given what's happening right now. I mean, they made a massive bet that this thing was going to go away. I really do think that over the summer they thought, okay, we're going to open up the country. We're going to declare victory and it's going to go away. All the scientists are wrong. And oh my God, the human cost is so dramatic and people are seeing it, but he is spreading this misinformation. So it makes it worse. Okay. So
just really quick here this morning, like again, cause I just woke up to it. We've been, you know, more testing equals more cases. We have best testing, deaths way down. Hospitals have great additional capacity, exclamation point. Doing much better than Europe. Therapeutics working, exclamation point. It's just not true. I mean, you know, in Utah, in El Paso, Texas, the hospitals are running out of beds again. He thinks that he just can survive four more days keeping up this lie. And then who the hell knows what he does during the 8 weeks if he loses.
Well, wasn't it somebody in the Washington Post who said it's sort of the Obi-Wan Kenobi, these are not the droids you're looking for. Just to sort of like just trying to get Americans what you're actually seeing out there is not actually happening. It's magically disappearing. It's not going. Okay. Speaking of these rallies, okay, we can go a lot of different ways on all of this. Miles Taylor, who's been on this podcast, former chief of staff to the Department of Homeland Security, broke very heavily, very, very hard against the administration, has told very, very compelling stories, which you've written about, which we've talked about what was going on behind the scenes, the cruelty, all of the different ideas that they were able to. Many of them were able to slap down. Many of them they were not able to slap down. We're getting more details about the number of children who have been ripped from their parents and may never see them again. By the way, this is an atrocity, but let's move on. So Miles Taylor then somewhat belatedly comes out and says, and by the way, I was also anonymous. 2 years ago, he wrote that anonymous op-ed piece in the New York Times, where he was described as a senior official, not really. And then he turned that into a book, which came out about a year ago. I was among those who said at the time that there's an expiration date for anonymity, and we were way past it by this point. If you got a problem, you got to put your freaking name on it, because we had a lot of folks that were coming out during the impeachment and laying their names on the line, and anonymous didn't do it. Well, to his credit, eventually, Miles Taylor did come forward belatedly and put his name on it. But the president is obsessed with this. And so there's a lot of different ways we can go here. But I was really struck by yesterday how a lot of people on the right are saying, no, the big fight of our time is about free speech and against cancel culture. But apparently they draw an exception for the president of the United States, who's way into cancel culture. Let's play this from yesterday.
But praise for the Trump. Oh, it's incredible, incredible. Then somebody gets him at the New York Times, the fake New York Times, and all of a sudden he becomes nasty. And he writes, and they say, a top White House official. Well, he was a staffer. Lowe had nothing to do with the White House. He had nothing to do. And he goes in, and you know what? There should be major criminal liability for some scum like this.
Scum.
And you know, for scum. A year, everybody walks into my office, Secretary of State Pompeo. I could name every one of them, all good people. I'm looking at them and saying, I wonder if that could be the one, right? You know? And it turns out to be this lowlife that nobody knows who the hell he is. He had nothing to do with us. I don't think I ever met him, and I might have met him. I think somebody said, he has a picture of me standing someplace. This is a disgrace to our country. It shouldn't happen, and he should be prosecuted. Are you listening to me back in Washington? He should be prosecuted. Along with the New York Times, because it was a story made up. It was fake news made up by the New York Times.
So lock them up. Lock them up.
Yeah, a lot of ways you go with that, like you said. I do want to say just briefly on Miles before I rant about the president's just grotesque behavior. He should have said that he was anonymous when he first came out. We didn't know when he did the video with Arvat that he was anonymous, I think it would have made a lot more sense to come clean about that. If you're coming clean and speaking truth, and you know, I think that there was this yearning for people to speak truth, and that's why people responded so much to his video and then his future media.
Do you know
segments,
why he didn't? But then, I mean, like, he was asked about it on by Anderson Cooper. At the point that you're coming out, why don't you say?
I don't know. I think it's convoluted. You know, I think you get in your head about trying to be cute and trying to figure out how to come forward in a way that'll have the, I don't know. I can't, if I had the answer to that, I would answer it, but I think he should have. And I think that it hurt his testimony a little bit to then just reveal it, you know, a couple months later. That said, like, you know, say what you want about the media strategy. Like he came out and spoke the truth while a lot of other people hadn't. So good on him. And secondly, you know, this idea that the president always immediately goes to prosecution and to silencing people is, you know, if he was more competent, would be deeply concerning. And like there's a little bit of a boy who cries wolf over the fact that you don't want to soften your outrage because, oh, you know, we just kind of gotten used to the fact that the president threatens to put people in jail all the time. Happens all the time, you know, dime a dozen now. And so, you know, it doesn't usually happen. So nothing to get outraged about. And it is outrageous. It is the behavior of a tin pot dictator. And your point is exactly right, Charlie, that it reveals just how phony the whole outrage is over cancel culture. And it's just, while I'm sympathetic to certain cases, particularly of regular folks who've gotten a raw deal, and those should be litigated, as an overriding policy, time and again, what Donald Trump and his supporters reveal is we just want to cancel the people we don't like. Like, that's all this is about. And if somebody comes out and blows the whistle, they should be prosecuted. They should be fired. They should be perp walked out of the White House like Alex Vindman and his brother were. Newspapers should be shut down. We should redo libel laws. I mean, this is not a group that is arguing in good faith on behalf of free speech. That's not actually what's happening here.
I don't think so. So this is a little bit tangential in talking about Miles Taylor, but you know, he worked in the Department of Homeland Security. So a lot of the things he said relate to the decision with families and separation. And this week, right? Help me, I'm in the time warp, where we found out that more than 500 kids may not ever be reunited with their parents. And here's something else not to be numbed about, because in terms of just the foundational atrocities that we think about of moments where governments callously take babies away from their mothers, this happened in this country. Americans did this. Our government did this in real time. And this is one of those moments where we throw around terms like, you know, norms and decency and everything, but this ought to be really clear. People ought to understand the scenes if they can use their moral imaginations to imagine what it's like to be a child taken away from your parents by the state, or a mother seeing their children being dragged away, knowing they will never hear them. We wonder how other societies and other cultures were able to do something like that, but we're doing it right now. And this is not an old story. It's really, and we're making a decision right now whether we're okay with this.
Yeah, and there's this, you know, sort of narrative going around now among the Trump defenders, that it's like, well, I mean, you know, the parents don't actually want to be reunited with the kids. You know, and we're trying, but they don't want to. And it's just all such bullshit. It's just such bullshit. And I'm going to we have for the Bulwark Plus members, and I've said this on the Next Level podcast, but I just want to reiterate it because it's important. I've done some work out here with the mom community, which is in northwestern Guatemala. It's the indigenous, like the ancient Mayan indigenous community. And the people who they were fleeing a very violent region of the country. They came to the country as asylees at the end of the Obama administration to you know really give their kids a chance. They don't speak English. They don't speak Spanish. They don't speak Latin languages, right? They speak this ancient indigenous language, tribal language in Guatemala. So, you know, their integration into American society is like is more challenging, right, than somebody who speaks Spanish, right? They're just some basic things that you can't communicate, you don't understand. There's cultural things, there's language parts. And so when I think about what's happening at this border, I think about that because that's who this is, right? It's people from the Northern Triangle. And they come across the border, they don't speak English. All they know is that in America, you know, they'll be safe, they think, and that you know, you get treated fairly in America, that America is the place that you go. You come across the border, you don't understand what's happening. You have border security separate you from your kids. Then you don't know what their instructions are. They're yelling at you. You know, you get put into a cage and then you get deported back across the border. And maybe there's one person in your group who like speaks enough English or Spanish or something to figure out like what has happened. And they say, well, the kids are staying. They're you know being fostered. They're being sent to your second or third cousin or something, or they found a family for them. And so then you're what do you do? Try and just think about that fear, Charlie. Like, what do you do? Like you come back. You don't know what happened. You got jailed and then treated horribly. You had your kid ripped from your arms. Then you get deported back across the border. And it's like, well, you're not going to go back. You know, to get them, then you get a call from the U.S. government that are no wonder they're scared. They should be scared. We treated them horrible, like just reprehensibly. So I think that it is something that is easy for you know people to look away from, and I think that a lot of the Republicans have decided that the easy answer to this is like, well, you know, it's like it's. I mean, we've. You know, the parents didn't want to. No wonder they didn't want to come back after the inhumane treatment they got.
Well, and also this was the pro-life party and the party of family values and all of this. You had a piece last Sunday. You put out a newsletter, which I find very valuable. In fact, I have it up right now. A letter to good faith, you know, people who are wrestling with whether or not to vote for Trump. Did you have somebody in mind when you wrote this letter, by the way? You know, the message for reluctant Trumpers of good faith.
Yeah, because I did. I don't want to out them, but I was having a conversation with my mother, and so I come from a big Catholic family in St. Louis. My nuclear family was in Denver, but all my cousins and aunts and uncles are St. Louis, so it's a big, big Catholic family. And I was just kind of quizzing my mother on where everybody landed, you know, and it's like most kind of like a lot of families, I think most of the millennials are with Biden and most of her, you know, siblings and in-laws are with Trump and, you know, some of them aren't gettable. But there are others of them and then of her friends who are, you know, she is, you know, kind of a church lady, if you will. And so who are... They struggle with two things, right? They're genuinely and passionately pro-life voters as Catholics.
I have a lot of friends.
Yeah, and they also see the president for who he is, right? That this is a bad person, but you know, they weigh the policies and abortion in particular, but also the Green New Deal, and a lot of them watch Fox, and so they're under the impression that the Democrats have all gone crazy. They don't Fox doesn't spend a lot of time talking about the fact that Joe Biden's entire staff is like 1990s centrist DLC corporate types, but anyway, so they're worried that Joe Biden is going to go to the far left, and so I wrote this article for them and people like them, because it's not just them, right? There are more faithful Mormons like this, mainline Protestants who see Trump, and they're trying to balance and I think that because they're getting their information from Fox, they're getting a distorted version of Trump, and they're getting a distorted version of the Democrats, and Trump's tweets are on one side of the ledger, and abortion is on the other side of the ledger. And so I wanted to try to balance the ledger for them and say, look, it's not just the tweets. Look at the way that he has treated immigrants and people of color and seniors and vulnerable communities dying from this virus, and look at it clearly and then decide whether he has earned your vote. And you know, I have heard, not from my family, but I've heard from two people in Florida, great swing state, who said who this fit them. Like, they were like, I ended up deciding I couldn't do it, and I was going to vote for Biden. And one of the guys said that his kids are very happy with him. So I was happy to at least bring one family together at this time of political strife at the dinner table.
Well, why I found this very compelling, because I think there's been a tendency over the last few years, you know, to sort of stigmatize people who are on the other side and say, okay, it's because you're a racist or because you're stupid or because you went to where they were and talked to shared values. And I think that's why it's so powerful. And if I could read it just for a minute, because sure. you're talking about an America where you were taught to, you know, love the country because right matters. It's a country where we might make mistakes, but where we were a unique force for good, a place that is the light and hope of the world. Okay, so this is a shared vision, you know, America at its best. I'm not attacking you. We're talking about what we believe in. So if you don't agree that America is a place where right matters, that we're a special country with special responsibilities, then we are different from the regimes the world over. You can stop here because this pitch is not for you. But then you go through. In a place where right matters, we don't shut the door on refugees fleeing oppression and yearning to breathe free. We don't.
Quick
have
interruption. I know you got the pace going, but the Trump's sent a tweet yesterday on this point, on the refugee point, which is just which was so despicable. You lose all this. He says if Biden gets in, 700% more refugees from Somalia, and he lists two other countries. I forget. I think it was Syria, Somalia, and another country are going into Michigan, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania into your communities.
More brown people.
Yeah. Ugh. Anyway. Sorry. Continue.
Well, no, that's exactly it. You know, I mean, it used to be that we understood that this was the yearning to breathe free, that we didn't shut our doors on those people. We don't, if you're a country where right matters, have an explicit policy to rip young children from their parents' arms and then deport the parents, losing track of them, leaving their children orphaned in a foreign country. In a place where right matters, the president does not put someone who plots with white nationalist organizations in charge of the entire country's immigration regime. I think we know who that is, Mr. Miller. We don't bar mothers from visiting their dying babies because their country of origin happens to be majority Muslim. We don't put 18-year-old citizens in disgusting deportation cages without a lawyer for 3 weeks because they have brown skin and happen to be in a car with undocumented immigrants. And it goes on and on and on about, you know, if we are a good and decent people, this is not the way we behave. And so that's why I thought that this thing was really good, Tim, because it really was aimed to persuade. And I think this is one thing that we've kind of lost the willingness to try to persuade. There's so much of our dialogue is about just simply triggering the other side or making the other side weep or just bludgeoning them into something. But there is that moment where you go, look, you're a good and decent person. You are pro-life. You are pro-family. Do you understand what we are doing and how you can't support these policies if you believe what you say you believe? And so I think that's why this was so effective.
Yeah, thanks. I had my husband's a lib, and so I had him read it, and I made him mad a couple times with my, you know, sort of pans to Republican values gone past, and I was like, that's good. I hit the mark then, because that's who I'm talking to. Whether or not you believe that those Republican, you know, bromides that I grew up in were true, whether you believe that was true or that was BS now, the people that voters were talking to, the people were trying to persuade, did believe it at one point, at least. Maybe they don't believe it now, right? Maybe they no longer believe that we're a shining city on the hill and that America is a unique force for good in the world, but they believed it at one time, and some of them still believe it. And so I wanted to try to make a case to them on those grounds that sort of stripped away the tweets and stripped away, you know, a lot of the other, you know, more finger waggy elements of I think how we communicate at one another these days. And so I'm hoping that it had an impact. And then at the very end, I did also want to just make this reminder about Joe Biden and de-catastrophize the possibility of a Biden victory. And I, you know, I just had one or two paragraphs on that, but it was just simply, that's like, look, Joe Biden has promised to run as a bipartisan. He was the only one in the Democratic race who did. And if he doesn't, and if you're right and I'm wrong, and if AOC is actually the, you know, puppet master behind Joe Biden for the first 2 years, we'll do exactly what we did in 2010 and vote the bums out. And Obama didn't really, I know this is inconvenient to the Fox narrative, but like didn't do that much for the last 6 years of his presidency because Republicans ran everything. You know, the Republicans locked, you know, tied him up in oversight and, you know, blocked a lot of legislation. And so anyway, I hope that you know, if you are listening to this and you still have a friend in your life that's like this, fair warning, do not send this to your MAGA uncle. I had a couple of friends who got it and they're like, oh, it's a Republican message to Republicans. And they sent it to their dad. And, you know, now they're in a big fight with their dad. I'm like, do not send it to somebody who's got the red hat on. There's some people who are not reachable. This is solely for people that see Trump, recognize that he's a bad person, but are still putting the Green New Deal as a weightier factor on the other side of the ledger. That's the person we're trying to talk to. So don't, I don't want to create any unnecessary family feuds here.
Yeah, no, I don't worry about that sort of thing. Speaking of creating a family feud here, because you are so promiscuous in terms of your podcast activities, you're going on with Matt Lewis, who's been writing, who's anti-Trump, but has decided to make this pivot into how really, really scary Joe Biden is. And I think he's written about 10 columns about how Biden's going to pivot to the left. And he heard all kinds of terrifying things that Joe Biden is saying in all of this, that he's going to be just simply. So I hope you basically call bullshit on Matt.
I can't wait to argue with him about that. I hope he'll argue with me. And look, maybe I want to just caveat this, Charlie, that like it's not like there's a 0%. I'll try to fight with him. But I will say just for honesty to listeners, there's not a 0% chance that happens, right? No. Who knows? It's just that like if you look at the facts, if you look at the people who are around Joe Biden, it is you can criticize him for being the swamp, maybe. That might be the criticism. He's got a lot of lobbyists around him, but he certainly doesn't have a lot of radical leftists around him. And so you know, we'll see how things shake out. But I think that what ends up happening, the most likely scenario is that, like, you know, there's one crazy radical in the Department of Education at like a mid-level and, you know, at Miles Taylor's level, and that Fox turns them into the most important person in America. Because you know, it's hard to demonize Ron Klain, you know, and people, old centrist Democratic hands who have been around for ages that are actually going to staff this administration.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I saw a tweet when somebody talked about the gap between the professional pundit class and the people who actually cover, say, Biden world, because you look at those folks and they're pretty pragmatic. They're pretty reasonable. You're right. It is a non-zero
chance.
Jonathan
Martin to put that out there to his credit.
To his credit. I mean, there's going to be a lot of noise from the AOCs of the world and everything, but Biden has been very, very clear on all of this, and he does have to remind people every once in a while, you know what? The people you're talking about are the ones I beat. There was actually a primary, and they didn't win. Yeah. I won because I wouldn't go along with all of their things. So you went you and he to have a fight about this.
I'll listen
to it. Okay, so Tucker Carlson.
I'm the so dog happy. I was looking at the clock. I was like, are we going to get to Tucker? No. I need my dessert.
The dog ate his bullshit, apparently, or something. So he lost the package, which was the big story. He opened the vault. There was nothing there. Tell me what's going on here. UPS has now found the magic package.
I think we're all getting tired of the term Karen. And so I think we might need to change it to a Tucker, you know, you become a Tucker when you call the boss. If you have not watched, I highly recommend. I know everybody's nervous the next however many hours we have left, 80 hours, and you're going to be biting your nails and having a drink. Spend 4 minutes with Tucker because it is enjoyable. I mean, he goes on this thing where they lost his package. But then they found, and then he knows he's got criticized for not copying. He said, well, by the way, I had copies.
Wait, the whole point was that this was the only piece.
Yeah, I know. So he had to cover his tracks from the day before. He said, I actually did have copies, but you know, we were still worried about this mysterious stolen package. And he's like, and so UPS found it. They found the package, and you know, but we still don't know exactly what happened. And he said, I've been on with executives at UPS all day trying to figure out what happened to this package. How did it get lost? How did it get found? And it's like if you get a cold pizza delivery and from Papa John's, and you call the Papa himself to complain about it. It's insane. It's like the most normal thing happened. That's happened to all of us during this pandemic. You order something, it didn't come. And, a couple of days later, it showed up on your doorstep. End of story. And yet it is this whole time he needs to keep up this bit that, maybe somewhere deep inside the UPS processing plant in Los Angeles, there was a CIA plant who's protecting Hunter and Bubalinski from their crimes. The whole thing is just preposterous and makes him look ridiculous, and that is enjoyable for me.
Maybe it's sort of like a dress rehearsal for what they're going to do with the voting process. It's like, get people to believe that anything that has the slightest glitch to it might not be a coincidence. So yeah. Somebody wants this to happen. So
by the
you
way,
think it's just
gonna
a coincidence?
Get a vote count wrong somewhere. Can we just of say course, this? This is just, we're all humans. You know, delivery men lose boxes. Voting machines miscount votes every once in a while.
There are no coincidences, Mr. Miller. You think it's just a coincidence that there are these late votes coming in some of these states? Really? That there are people who mailed in their votes? Huh?
Who knows?
Who wants that?
Who knows, Charlie? And
George Soros, pizza pedophile, left-wing socialists. What?
They could be coming to the homes. You know, George could be sending people into people's homes to knock on doors. Why are people knocking on my door anyway? You know, maybe filling out ballots for people.
Okay, here's something to raise your blood pressure just a little bit. I do think that if this is not a close election, which I'm, knock on wood, there will still be attempts. You can see that the Republican Party is all in litigation, and the theme of all of their litigation is that they don't want certain ballots counted, which is an extraordinary thing for a political party to very publicly be doing, that they really kind of want to disenfranchise people and suppress the votes. That's literally the case. So there's going to be a lot of that. But it's going to be interesting to see what our good friends, the anti-Trumpers, do with this, whether they feel the need to go, well, actually, there are some serious issues here, and perhaps we ought not to allow this extra 100,000 votes in Pennsylvania to be cast. I mean, there's an off-ramp here for some people on the right to go, okay, Mr. Trump, you had your run, you lost the election, you need to move on. We're going to put the country before party and before Trumpism. So there is an off-ramp for some of those people. And I'm kind of still hoping, because I'm incredibly naive and because I'm an idiot, that maybe some elected officials will take that off-ramp. But it's going to be interesting to see where the anti-Trumpers, nobody's going to take the off ramp.
I want to hear you name names.
No. See, that would be mean. I would. I don't want to beat up on National Review and Hugh Hewitt and Rich Lowry and your friend Matt Lewis. I don't know. I go with Washington Examiner, Free Beacon. I mean, why do that?
Commentary. Yeah. I don't know either. I'm just making a commentary.
Commentary.
Here's the thing. I mean, if he gets
Peggy Noonan,
if he gets beaten clearly, then maybe there's their off ramp. But you still are going to get this thing like you did with the FISA reform, where it's like, I didn't actually care about it, but there's one, there was this one issue, and now this is a serious issue, and we do have to now take it seriously, and looking at the way that the ballots are counted, and you'll get that, and you'll get lack of trust in institutions. How can you blame people for not trusting, these institutions?
Why won't CNN cover this? Here's a story. And the real story is that Twitter.com did not allow this particular tweet out there. So there's always just that slight misdirection where we're not actually saying that Hunter Biden's a pedophile, but we are saying that the mainstream media is not really aggressively enough pursuing this story, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. Or that there's something to it that, you know, the Trump may be a little go overboard, or use, but there's something to the critique here. There's no benefit to them to just say it's over. You got your ass kicked. There's no problem with the election,
yeah.
Right? Like this, so they're not going to do it. They'll just hide under. Just like again, it's the same. Just like with these rallies. Just like why nobody's speaking about these rallies. Just why everybody's coming up with the stupid excuse about how the parents don't want to be reunited with their children. It doesn't. There's nothing. There's no level of absurdity that they won't just go along with the talking point. And so that's
okay. You know what? I can't disagree. So you know what I got to go do now?
What's up?
Okay, so we had the full podcast. I'm not cutting this short, but I'm actually going to spend a few minutes on my old radio station.
Okay.
The one where I was a talk show host for 23 years. And I had a really good rapport with my audience until the Trump thing. Now they all hate me.
I hear occasionally from a longtime listener. Yeah. I got a DM last night from a longtime Charlie Sykes listener. So you got a couple out there.
Hater.
10 of them.
Yeah.
No, liked you.
No. So. Oh, no. Well there's the haters. Like, you were a conservative, and but because you didn't go along with Trump, you have sold out. And so I'm sort of taking a deep breath here, going back on. The good news is that the host is my longtime producer, who was actually with me through the whole soul crushing experience of 2016. So we're having these flashbacks. He reminded me of something. Okay, you know, you feel old. 5 years ago yesterday, you know what happened? Paul Ryan was elected Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Wow,
that was 5 years ago. You know, don't you feel like you're like looking over the fence in like this distant world over there?
Whatever happened to Paul Ryan?
See, this is the thing.
Where is that guy?
I made it clear. I'm a big fan. It was very, very disappointing. But when you think of the possibility and the hopes and everything of what he could have been, what he represented, and now what happened to him? I mean, really, it's kind of the story of our time.
In a literal sense, like, does he live in Janesville? Does he live in New York?
He's out. He's on the coast. He's on the board of Fox News or Fox Corporation. He's one of the Fox boards.
Is that a real job though? It's like you have meetings or?
Oh, he's I don't know if it's a real job, but he's out there. He's not going to be in politics anymore. And it's like, oh boy, talk about. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when he was the future. Although, in retrospect, his instinct not to become speaker was right. He should have stuck with that one. I mean, he knew this was a shitty job. He had no idea how shitty it was going to be.
Who would have thought that Kevin McCarthy would have been the longest standing young gun? You had Eric Cantor, and that's also in New York, and then he's silent. You don't. There's a lot of people who. There's an op-ed this morning in the Detroit News. This one, a really quick shout out from Josh Venable, who I used to work with on Jeb at the RNC. He was Betsy DeVos's chief of staff. And he's been texting me, and finally he was just like, I've had enough. I'm writing this op-ed. I just can't do it. And good on him. And about how he can't support Trump. And when you start to think about it, it is amazing how many people have just gone with strategic silence. So anyway, I digressed from your radio hosting. No. But like, you know, you think about this, the Eric Cantors and the Paul Ryans and the John Boehners and Bill Frist. You know what I mean? Like, you can think about it. There's so many people that could have been the vocal, anti-Trump conscience. And just every single one of them, I guess Rick Snyder came out today and said something, but like basically every single one of them, you know, just have decided to hide under a rock.
I have to say though, that in some ways I prefer the strategic silence folks to the ones who turned themselves into the total fluffers and turd like
Walker. Yeah. You'll take Paul Ryan over Walker.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. I mean, at least Paul Ryan is keeping his head down. He's not defending the indefensible. He's not tweeting out Charlie Kirk level sort of things like the former governor. We've defined cowardice down, I suppose, but I'm willing to take strategic silence versus cheerleading into the apocalypse. Okay.
I've got one last thing for you really quick, Charlie. One last thing. I want to make everybody nervous here. I've had a good run this year, okay? I used to be the cooler. John Weaver used to call me the cooler on my Boss Huntsman campaign. And I've had a good run, and I got my 270 to win out. and I'm looking at my map, and I have Joe Biden with 299 electoral votes, and I don't know how he gets less. And I think that he could get I'm trying to do this now, man. He could have 380.
Sunshine.
And I don't know, and it's really freaking me out. I want to change one of the colors to red so that I'm not jinxing it.
What was your other reputation? You were like the storm cloud, right? You were
the rain cloud. Yeah.
The rain cloud. People would be feeling good and happy, and then you would walk in as like, oh, here comes Miller. But you're saying you're kind of sunshine today.
I mean, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Florida. And that's the ball game. It's over.
Yeah, Florida. I wish I felt better off Florida.
Every poll that's been out lately,
I know
Florida has been good, and our internal RVAT poll had it going the right direction. It's just like, how can you not look at Florida and think it's a lean Biden state right now with how bad Trump's doing with seniors?
Well, the seniors is the big story. You know, everybody has been hanging out at the truck stops in Western Pennsylvania when apparently the story is Granny who's living in the retirement home down in Florida.
Should have been at that old country buffet for the 4:45 dinner in Naples. That would have been how you get your finger on the pulse of what was happening. New York Times, that's
journalism the next 4 years. All the reporters hanging out at the country kitchen. Tim Miller, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I am Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday and do this all over again, because as of right now, there's only 4 days left to go.
Ugh.
Okay.